getting closer. Indianapolis 500 Sunday afternoon here on the radio and live everywhere on NBC, WPHR 13 in Indianapolis. 1 o'clock coverage, 2:30 green flag. And this is the talk of Gasoline Alley, where we talk about the previous 103 Indianapolis 500s and more concerning the world's greatest race course. I'm Kevin Lee. Donald Davidson is with us, the historian of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and Mike Thompson of the IMS Museum, and more classic audio a little later on in the program. Donald, we talked about this. We don't need to get into it anymore. We did this last week. I asked you about the auto races in 1909, but I see the IMS Museum tweeted today that it was today, 111 years ago today, the first auto races happened, and a few pictures in there as well. And what struck me, along with how cool the pictures are, but a picture of the ticket and the wing and wheel, the wing and wheel logo in 1909, and how enduring that is. And I wish I knew who came up with that. Do you know who came up with that? And kudos to them.
You know, I do not. I know that it goes back to the very beginning and it's changed over the years, but I've heard different versions of where that came from. And I can't even think of the claims now, but apparently there were other companies that had something similar that predate the Speedway. So whether that was influenced by something or it was just a coincidence, I really don't know where that comes from, but it does go back to the very beginning. And I think the thinking was in the beginning that there would be an aviation presence as well as an automobile presence. And as far as you noting the anniversary there, this was the first day 111 years ago on which there was automobile racing. Now, they'd had the National Balloon Championships on June the 5th when the track was barely started. And then they hurried up to get what was going to be 2 days of motorcycle racing on August the 13th and 14th. And as I think we documented a few days ago, the first day was Friday. Friday the 13th got rained out. So that was the Speedway's first rain out 111 years ago. And so then they pushed it to Saturday and Monday because they weren't going to run on Sunday, but they had problems with the track breaking up. And they canceled the Saturday event after 7 of 8 events, and they did not come back on Monday. And then the automobile races were 3 days, August 19th, 20th, and 21st. And I don't remember the exact number of events now, but there was probably, 16, 18, 19, 20 races over a three-day period. And this was the first day. So I haven't been on there to see what photographs were selected, but yes, 111 years ago today, the first automobile races at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and having a 500-mile race was not in their thinking at that time.
Yep. All right, let's get to telephone calls at 317-239-1070. I understand lines are full, so when someone hangs up, that's your chance to call in. Mike in Akron starts us off first tonight. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Mike. Hi, gentlemen. Hello. I have a question about your yearbook, Don. Well, first, can I give a fast 15-second comment here? A lot of people are sad with the fact that there's not going to be any fans in the stands, but I tell you, we almost lost Enzo Ferrari in the 1918 pandemic, and there was no race at all, as you guys know better than me, during the Great Depression and during World War II. And after World War II, I mean, there was weeds growing up in the front straightaway. We almost lost the track. So the track's in better shape it's ever been in with Penske. I'm going to be real happy and real grateful for this race. So, Donald, about your yearbooks, they were incredible. I have the 75 one of the highlights of my library. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about making it. How come it just came out for 2 years? I mean, they were excellent, better than any of them, even better than Climbers. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about them.
Well, you're very kind. It was a lot of work. 74 and 75 were the 2 years. And what happened was that Floyd climbers went from, well, starting in 46, he put out a publication that went from 1909 to 41, which was magazine reprints of each year up to that point. So it was called Floyd Climbers Indianapolis 500 Mile History Book. And there was very, very little original in there. They were, as I say, they were all magazine reprints, but the magazine coverage was phenomenal. And so that came out in 46. And then after the 46 race, he did a very thin supplement, which is stapled. And then he did a supplement in 47, 48. 49 was a little more substantial. And then 50, it came out it was called a year book, and it had a spine. It went up all the way through 1968. And I was, a lot of my early knowledge came from the Floyd Climbing Yearbooks. I mean, that was my Christmas day every year when that came out. I mean, it was just phenomenal how important those publications were to me. And then when I showed up and I met Floyd Climber, and then the final one was 1968, and I was the editor. And I'll never forget this, my phone ringing. I was young, and the phone rang one Sunday morning, and it was like, 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning. And this voice says, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Hello, who's this?" He said, "This is Floyd Climber, what are you doing?" I said, "What time is it for you?" He's calling from California, and it had to be, 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning. Anyway, the bottom line to that was, he said, "How would you like to edit our yearbook? We need an editor. How would you like to do it?" So I edited the 1968 book and put a lot of work into that. And then we had already started on the 1969 book, and we're far along, and Floyd Climber passed away near the end of the year, I think. And so all of the work was done. We'd even been proofreading galleys. I mean, it wasn't finished, but it was well along. And then his widow decided that they would not publish. But I tried to make an arrangement to take over the title. And so anyway, that fell through. And then I talked with a couple of fellows locally about doing one for 1973. So 70, we didn't do one. 71, 72. In 71 or 2, there was a publication that was sort of patterned after the yearbook. And this is, again, it's more of an answer than you wanted. But I was pretty far along, I thought, with doing one in 1973. And then we found out that Carl Hungus was doing one as well. And it was going to be a little confusing because one was going to be the 500 year book and the other one was going to be the Indianapolis Speedway annual or something like that. And so it ended up that we didn't do one in 73. And then the Carl Hunger series started in 73 and then went all the way through to 97, I think was the last one. And anyway, so I did the 1974 and 75 books. And then in 1976, I wasn't able to do it because, and this is a very long and bold story, but I was working for the United States Auto Club, and I had the opportunity of a lifetime, I had the opportunity of many lifetimes to be an official on a USAC-sanctioned run, which required me being out of the country for about 3 months. It was actually the bicentennial. It was one lap of the globe, except, of course, there's a lot of places where you couldn't drive. Again, more of an answer than you wanted here. But it was Pontiac and National Car Rental teamed together to do this run. And there was a Pontiac Grand Prix. And the prime driver in that was Johnny Parsons Sr., winner of the 1950 500, whom I already knew and got to know a lot better. And then there was the Pontiac Sunbird, which is, I suppose, what you'd call a pony car that was not available to the public yet, but was the prototype was ready to go. And Paula Murphy, the drag racer, the lady drag racer, was the driver of that. Anyway, there was a crew. There was the two drivers and a crew of five accompanying them in a truck, and we all sort of moved back and forth from vehicle to vehicle. And I was the USAC observer that recorded all of the information on the entire trip. And we went through 32 countries, and I think we drove through 28. It's a long story, as you well. It already is a long story. We left. We left the Daytona Speedway on July the 4th of 1976, and Paula and I were in the pace lap, the parade lap of the Firecracker 400, which used to start at 10 o'clock in the morning then. And Johnny Parsons in the Grand Prix was up in Minneapolis, and then we rendezvoused in New Orleans, and then we drove all the way down through Central and South America. And we flew to we flew from Rio de Janeiro to Casablanca, and then we went across the Straits of Gibraltar on a ferry, and then drove from the south coast of Spain all the way through Europe, Iran, Afghanistan, and then Pakistan and India, and then, you know, Greece and Turkey in no particular order, and then we got to Bombay. And then we flew back to Anchorage, Alaska, came down the Alcan Highway. Anyway, there's more to it, but we were gone 3.5 months. And we actually, Paula and I, ended up at Daytona on a Sunday morning. I think it was October the 17th. And Big Bill France and Bill France Jr. were there to greet us. Anyway, because we were gone 3.5 months, I thought, I can't do the book again. And as luck would have it, if you like, the race was rain shortened and it only went halfway anyway. And so I put a lot, thank you for the comments on the 74-75 book, put a lot of effort into those two things. And I'm very proud of them. I mean, I take them down occasionally and have a look through and think, yeah, not bad, not bad. And so anyway, thank you for asking. It was, this ended up being more of a travelogue than anything else, but what a pleasure to be able to ride with Paul Murphy and Johnny Parsons both. And and although we would do occasional relief jobs, they were the prime drivers on the two cars that I mentioned. I was the only person who relief drove on both of them. And so I spent time riding with Johnny Parsons, and the story that he told me about, you know, just racing in general, his experiences and going to meet Ferrari in Italy in 1952 and so on and so forth, just was a priceless experience. And then when I came back, and I didn't do a yearbook again. But anyway, thank you for asking about it.
Thank you, Mike.
And people say, so did you know Johnny Parsons Sr.? I said, very well, as a matter of fact, because it was just the seven of us traveling, and all we did was just drive the cars and stay at the hotels and then get up the next day and drive the cars again.
317-239-1070 is the number. Another Mike in Vernon Hills joins us next. Hi, Mike. You're with Donald.
Hi, Mike.
Hi, gentlemen. Hi, guys. How are you?
Okay.
Great.
Good. Hey, great shows this year, and I appreciate everything you guys done for us fans in an odd year.
Okay, thank you.
Donald, I wonder if you could talk about Dale Drake.
Dale Drake? He was Louis Meyer's partner in the Alfie business. The company that was started by Harry Miller and then was taken over by one of his lieutenants, Fred Offenhauser, in 33 or 34, I think. Harry Miller fell on hard financial times, and Fred Offenhauser was able to acquire the company, and then it was Offenhauser, and everybody called them the Offie. And then I've never been able to determine a date on this, but either late 45 or early 46. I've never found a date, but somewhere in a few month period there, Fred Offenhauser sold the business to Louis Meyer, three-time 500 winner, and Dale Drake. And then they continued it on until 1964, when Ford Motor Company had come back in. And after running in 63 with just the Lotus cars and then developing a new engine, a double overhead camshaft engine, which was then available to teams in 64, they didn't want to be in charge of that themselves. They would have the engines built, but they wanted a distributor. And so Louis Meyer had a long relationship with Henry Ford and Ford Motor Company. And so he became the distributor, and he thought that it would be a conflict of interest. And so he sold his interest to Dale Drake. And then Louis was set up, actually, a little strip mall, that's hard to believe now, 30th and Georgetown. If you go down behind, I think, Big Lots, I don't know if that's still Big Lots, it was the AMP food market at one time, but if you go to the south of that, there's several like little garages down there, and one of those was where Louis Meyer Incorporated was, and they... All of the it had been Racing Associates with Herb Porter and Rocky Phillip, and A.J. Foyt used to keep the Traco sprint car in there. Boy, we're going all over the place for this, aren't we? We're supposed to be talking about Dale Drake. Anyway, Dale was the son. There was a company called J.A. Drake and Sons. I think, did they make carburetors, I think? Oh, no, they made valves, because the product was Jadson. Jadson, J-A-D-S-O-N, which was actually derived from J.A. Drake and Sons. And I think that Dale Drake was one of the sons, I think. Jadson actually was on a car that Louis Meyer owned in 1931 that was started by Myron Stevens. And after Louis' Sampson special dropped out, he got into the Jadson car. Myron Stevens got out of the driver's seat, ran around, got in the riding mechanic seat, and then they finished fourth. And then Dale Drake was on Louis pit stops, I think, in 1936. He wasn't chief mechanic, but I think in 1936, and they had very small teams in those days. They didn't have dozens and dozens of people involved with the racing operation like they do now. And I think in 36, the winning crew, I think, was sort of like five or six people. And Dale Drake was, I think, like maybe a strategist or pit manager or something like that, I think. He wasn't the chief mechanic, although there's been a claim to that effect, but we can't authenticate that that's in fact what happened. And so... I'm sure he was involved in other years. I think, he was a riding mechanic one year. I think there's shots, little hazy on this, 30, 31. I think there's some shots of him in the riding mechanic seat. And that might be during practice, not necessarily the race. And people who are great photograph collectors will know that dilemma. Just because you've got a photograph with somebody sitting in the seat as a riding mechanic, that might have been on May the 17th during practice, and that's not necessarily who rode it in it with the race. So a little bit hazy on that one. But then Dale Drake then to come forward after Louis sold out his interest, it then became Drake Engineering and then continued on until, I don't remember when Dale Drake passed away, his son took over the business, and of course they continued to run. It was now, Drake Engineering. It had been Meyer and Drake, and now Drake, but everybody still called the engine the Oppie. And then they started to turbocharge circa 1966 with a couple, and before long, all of the Oppies were turbocharged. And then Ford turbocharged, and then they had but it was a four-cylinder. It was still a four-cylinder Oppie, but turbocharged. And they developed a V8 a little bit later in 79 or 80, maybe, little hazy on this. And there were several Drake V8s that were never very successful. And I think it certainly, it had quite a financial burden on the company, the cost of trying to develop this engine to try and, go head-to-head with Ford Motor Company. Anyway, I met Dale Drake. I did not spend a lot of time with him, but as with so many people in racing, he was very unassuming and just a very, very nice man. So I don't know that I really did a fair appraisal of him here, but that's about all I can think of right now.
All right. Thank you, Mike. Right. More of your questions for Donald are coming up, and our Blast from the Past audio is next on the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
And it's a joyous celebration down here as they're wiping Bill Vukovich's face off now, all that drive. And how about it was, Bill?
I can't hear a thing.
He can't hear a thing right now. It's the engine noise. It was just deafening. And so we're waiting now as he takes off his helmet. He's getting a drink of water, Wilbur's water from the beautiful gold cup, ice water. And he's sitting there waiting now, waiting for the award of the trophy from Marie Wilson, the movie and TV star that is standing right to our right. It's a tremendous uproar here in the Victory bullpen as Bill Vukovich has become the winner of the 38th annual 500-mile race. He's taking his helmet off. He's getting a rag now from mechanic Jack Beckley. He's waiting. He looked very, very happy and very grimy at the moment. He said he couldn't hear a thing. And he's being congratulated now by the 1951 winner Lee Wallard, shaking his hand. This is a tremendous sight. Bill, can you hear us now, Bill? How did you like that race?
To win the race. I really don't know what to say.
Bill, did you plan to only make two pit stops all the way?
Well, we just ran till the tires wore out. We just got lucky, I guess.
How was the heat this year as compared with last? And now he's being interrupted by some very important business, being kissed by Marie Wilson. Oh, man. And now he's being kissed by his wife, Esther. And is he happy? And Bill is climbing back up on the car. Bill, how was the heat this year compared with last?
Well, it wasn't hot this year. It was pretty cool all the way through.
Bill, that was quite a struggle getting up there from way back in the pack, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's a hard row to hoe from back there, I'll guarantee you.
When did you feel you had that race won?
Oh, I didn't know. We just figured we'd keep running and see what happened.
Well, you really did it, Bill Vukovich. Congratulations. You're the third man in history to win this 500-mile race two times in succession. And here's the first man to do it, Wilbur Shaw. Wilbur, what did you think?
Well, you did a wonderful job again. You certainly are a champion of the first one.
Wilbur, what did you think of this automobile race?
The most beautiful race we've ever had, the most beautiful start. From start to finish, it's been wonderful.
And even the Wilbur Shaw weather held up.
Perfectly wonderful. I'm more certain every day that God is a 500-mile race fan.
Thank you very much, Wilbur Shaw.
And I thought about this today. Since that year in 1954, only twice has someone won the 500 in consecutive years. Simon Pagenaud is the latest to have a chance to do it in consecutive years and become the third since 1954. It's the Talk of Gasoline Alley. Kevin Lee, Donald Davidson, and Mike Thompson from the IMS Museum joins us now. Mike, that's a pretty good one.
Yeah, I really like that one. We had a special request, two different requests, actually. Lawrence on Twitter requested, he said he wanted to hear Bill Vukovich, so I wanted to make sure to take care of that for him. And for my dad, who's listening in my beloved hometown of Toledo, Ohio, my dad wanted to hear Wilbur Shaw. So I thought if I could somehow combine both of them into one segment tonight, we were able to do that. So nice. Able to get Bill Vukovich and Wilbur Shaw in the same segment. And one of my favorite parts about that particular clip is the fact that Bill Vukovich says it wasn't hot this year. And any of the fans out there who know anything about photography or are interested in photography, there's that famous shot of Bill Vukovich on the workbench where he looks really spent. And it's one of the most famous pictures probably in 500 history. And it's really one of the most requested shots that the Speedway Photoshop gets. That's actually from 1954. It's a common misconception that it's from 53, which people think is the hottest 500. It's actually tied for the second hottest 500. But it's a common misconception that that photo is actually from 53. It's actually from 54. So I actually, when I heard that clip today, was a little interested for him to say, oh, it's really not that hot. And then a few minutes later, he goes back on the workbench and is taking a little bit of a break when somebody took that famous photograph. And that photograph is legendary. And I mean, there are several 500 drivers that I've actually been in the photo shop when they went in to request that photo because they wanted it for their house. So a couple different guys, I was actually in there when they said, I want that picture on my wall, because to them, that symbolizes what the Indianapolis 500 really is all about.
Well, maybe he was just worn out from doing interviews, which he apparently didn't really enjoy all that much. Donald, go ahead.
Yeah.
I've got several words.
Yeah.
Well, I've got several comments here. 1953 was the year of the heat. I think that the air temperature, I think, was like 92 or something. The thing about 54, it was very, very humid. And the relief drivers that were once very common had begun to diminish. In fact, in 1951, there was only one relief driver. And in 1952, was the first 500 in which there were no relief drivers. But in 53, there were quite a bunch. And in 54, there were quite a bunch. And in fact, there was a record set when Art Cross, who led the race from the back of the field, was overcome by the heat. So it is interesting that Bookers would say that. At 300 miles, Johnny Parsons got in, who was out of the race, drove it for about 20 laps, came in and said, it's too hot for me. Sam Hanks got in, ran it for about 20 laps, and said, too hot for Sam. Andy Linden got in. And then finally, Jimmy Davies got in and finished the race. And I'm not making that up. The car finished 11th, and it had five drivers: Art Cross, Johnny Parsons, Sam Hanks, Andy Linden, and then Jimmy Davies. And then a little side note, when I got a few other items here, I'll just pop all these off if that's okay. Somebody told me that legendary photograph of Perkovich on the workbench, just exhausted in 54, somebody told me that Jack Roush has a huge blow-up of that, and it's in his office. And when anybody would go in, one of the crew or the team manager or somebody would go in to have a complaint about conditions, apparently Jack Roush would say, you see that? That's the 500 winner. That's what the drivers used to go through. Anyway, there was a reference. Charlie Brockman refers to Jack Beckley as the mechanic. Rather an unusual setup, because Bukovich's mechanics in 52, 53, 54, and 55 were Frank Kuhn and Jim Travers. And Beckley had been with Jack McGrath for several years. But in 54, he was on with Travers and Kuhn. And I think Jack might have been the engine man, but basically they were like, triple chief mechanics that year. And somebody called in last night. We didn't get to want to talk about Al Gordon. I was hoping that we might get to that one, if that fellow would like to call back. And then a little editorial comment that occurred to me this afternoon, where I got so many people lamenting the fact that by not being able to go this year, that it will break their streak. And so it occurred to me this afternoon, for some reason, I thought, you know what? Things will be back on track next year, hopefully, and we'll never have this again. And so anybody that did not come this year because, you know, they were prevented from coming because of the what the situation they're faced with, from next year on and in years to come, they will be able to say, I've been to every Indianapolis 500 in May since 1959 or 1962 or whatever it was. So I ran that by a couple of people that thought that was pretty neat. So if you're one of the people that can't go this year, go next May, and then you can make that claim that you've been to everyone in May for however many years it is. Anyway, a couple of other comments here, but maybe we should move on and get the phone call.
I think the general consensus is that this year doesn't count for any streaks. Yeah. If no one is allowed to come, then just forget about it. This is the oddest year, hopefully, we will ever endeavor. I heard Doug Bowles say this. I've mentioned this on the other show before. But if you missed a race in the 70s because you were serving in Vietnam or at any time, you know, that shouldn't count either. That's not your fault. You were serving the country.
People, Yeah, I've had a lot of people that you know, they said, I've been to everyone since whatever it was, but I had to miss when I was in Korea or Vietnam. Yeah. And there's another thing that we haven't had to face for a while. There were drivers that actually had to miss a 500 because of military service. And I mentioned Jimmy Davies. In 1952, Jimmy Davies and Jerry Hoyt, neither one of them were in the 500. Davies was in Korea. Jerry Hoyt was in Germany serving with the forces. 500-mile race driver, sorry, son, that don't count. Off you go.
All right, back to our telephone calls. He could maybe just yell out his window and I might hear him. John in Plainfield is next with Donald. Hi, John.
Hey, John.
Maybe that's the problem. John. He's trying to yell out the window instead of talking into the phone.
Oh, that's it. Yes, very good.
Going once. Okay, you just barely got in. Go ahead, John.
Okay, Donald, I know you were involved with the radio network virtually from the beginning of your time at the Speedway. I was wondering if you've ever had the opportunity to watch the 500, even part of it, from the outer perimeter of the track. And as a follow-up, what would be your vantage point of choice if you were freed up from your official duties for one race day?
Good question. Now, the answer is no. My first year, I sort of roamed the place. I never sat in a grandstand, but I had the run of the place. So I was up and down the pits. I hung out at a few pits. I went down in the first turn. I took advantage of the some of the hospitality areas, so as they were in those days. Champion Spark Plug had a little place underneath the grandstands where you could go in and get a Coke and maybe a ham sandwich or something. It wasn't like it is today. But then starting in 65, then I was involved in the broadcast. But I can give the answer to your question. I always thought that if I didn't have the the race day situation, I think that the best seat would be at the end of the straightaway, just going into the turn or maybe partially into the turn, and so that you could see the pit stops. And for the last, 25, 30 something years, I've had more people swear by turn three. And they say you can see more of the track. You come through, you can see the South Short Chute from all the way down there, and then all the way down, through turn three and over to four before they disappear again. And I thought, well, and I've had so many people that say that those are the best seats, but I've always thought, I think I would want to see the straightaway. And they said, well, we've got the Jumbotron screens. And I thought, well, yes, but I still think that I'd like to be able to see the pit stops and, the checkered flag and so on and so forth. So I think that would be my choice if I was going to be a spectator on race day. But thank you. Good question. Yeah.
Thank you, John, for the question. 317-239-1070 is the number. I'm going to try to sneak in a couple of the Twitter questions. This is from Timothy Roberts and says, could you ask Donald to tell us about the Studebakers at the 500? My grandfather was a Studebaker and Packard dealer in Brownwood, Texas. He was invited to attend the 500 one year.
There were several cars in the 1930s that had Studebaker power plants. There's a little bit of a misunderstanding over a car in 1924. Earl Cooper finished second in a car called the Studebaker Special. It was a 100% Miller that was sponsored by Studebaker, just as the year before there had been the 8CS Special, so that's a whole other story. But the 1924 Studebaker Special was a 100% Miller racing car with the Studebaker logo. There were Studebaker-powered cars. In fact, in 1930, when the specifications changed, for reasons that I'm not going to go into now, that's other than what is, it was nothing to do with the Wall Street crash, is the bottom line on that. You either know what I'm talking about or don't worry about it. But there was, the specifications were changed for 1930 by Eddie Rickenbacker. with a view to having the manufacturers return. Because when he came to run the track and took it over in 27, it was straight eight Duesenbergs and straight eight Millers, rear drive and front drive with superchargers. And he thought, wait a minute, when I was a driver here before World War One, we drove for the factories. I drove for Maxwell. They were building passenger cars. What happened here? And so he wanted to get the specs back. Well, in the meantime, the Wall Street crash took place, and I'll just thump the lectern just a little bit here. I keep reading what the so-called junk formula, which I think is a very unkind term, came in out of necessity because of the Wall Street crash, and that's nonsense. Rickenbacker developed those specifications in the summer of 1928, and they were announced in January of 1929. This is what we're doing next year. And that's 10 months before the Wall Street crash. Well, anyway, in the meantime, we had the Wall Street crash, and a lot of the factories that might have produced a car for the 500, now they did not for financial reasons. There were some engineers at Studebaker. There was Bill Richards and, golly, I can't think of the name of them now, but their initials were, they entered a car called the Rumpthe Special, R-O-M-T-H-E, and that was the initials of the surnames of the Studebaker engineers that did this program. And then in 1931, there was a car called the Hunt Special, wriggling and Henning body, and a Studebaker President engine. And in fact, Hunt was the H of Rumpthe. And Tony Gallotta drove that and actually was just about to take the lead after Billy Arnold had crashed. And before Gallotta could have a chance to get the lead, he also was in an incident and took the car out. Anyway, because of the promise it showed, Studebaker said for 1932, let's do a program. And so they ordered three or four more cars from Rigling and Henning. And there was a five-car factory Studebaker team in 32. And Cliff Brazier finished third. And then there was Zeke Meyer, and I haven't done this one for a while, Peter Chris, Luther Johnson, and I can't think of the other one at the moment. It'll come to, yeah, it was... Zeke Meyer was ninth. No, wait a minute. Brazier was third, and then Rush Snowberger in a private entry had a Studebaker engine in 1931 that had started on the pole, although he wasn't the fastest qualifier, and he had finished fifth. And then in 33. Of those five Studebakers, there were three finished, and two of them had a wheel. There was like a wheel bearing problem. Like, it was Peter Chris, and brain fade at the moment. Anyway, for 1933. They rebodied Tony Gallotta. They rebodied four of the five cars, and this year all of them finished, and they finished seventh, ninth, 10th, 11th, and 12th, and the eighth place was taken by Rush Snowberger, who in 32 had used a Hotmobile engine instead of the Studebaker, but for 33, he put the Studebaker back in. So anyway, I talked to Cliff Brazier about those cars, and he said actually that it was the streamlining. The cars didn't work as well, that if they had left them the way they were in the 1932 configuration, and one of those, it was Laura Coram. Gallotta drove one, Brazier drove one, Luther Johnson, and then Laura Coram had the one that still had the 1932 configuration. And then there were a couple more Studebaker power plants in cars for off and on for the next few years. And in fact, a Studebaker was entered in 1953 I don't know that this engine ever got on the track, but Chuck Stevenson in 53 drove for Agajanian, and it was going to be a Studebaker power plant, but he had ended up, they put an RP in Agajanian's car. And then in 56, Lindsay Hopkins was there with a Studebaker, which somebody told me was the same engine that they were going to run in 53. A mechanic named Willie Uxman had developed that one. But anyway, I don't think I did you a very good job with this one, just jumping around. I was going to do the relief driver, Sam Palmer, and, as I say, Luther Johnson from South Bend, and it was quite an operation. The cars were, as I say, the wriggling and heading bodies in 32. They kept them up in South Bend, so they were actually racing cars, but the power plants were Studebaker President engines, and I think that they were prepared in that Studebaker building that's still there to this day, which is now where the museum is. I think I'm right in saying that that's the same building where those cars were prepped. I might be off a little bit on that one.
Thank you, Timothy. More for Donald in a moment. It's the talk of Gasoline Alley on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan. Back to it on the talk of Gasoline Alley, and Jonathan in Chicago is next with Donald Davidson. Thanks for hanging on, Jonathan.
Hey, Jonathan. Good evening, gentlemen. I was wondering, given there was no race in 1918, if there was any sort of effect on the 1919 race from the Spanish flu. I know that that was sort of the tail end of the Spanish flu was going on, and if you could just do a profile on the 1919 race.
Oh, okay. Sure. But before I do that, let me take care of a little business. I didn't give the smoothest answer on Studebakers because I was thinking of several things at the same time. I know I didn't mention all of them, but there's one point that I wanted to make about when I said in 32 that a couple of them dropped out late because of a wheel bearing problem. In 33, although seventh was the best finish compared with Berger, third in 32, I don't think I made the point that all five cars went the 500 miles, but it took a little while to get there because in those days they used to let the cars run after the winner had crossed the line. And this ties in with, for those of you that were not listening years ago and heard the Vukovich interview, you heard the cars running. That's because they would let the race run for another 15, 20, 25 minutes to let as many cars as reasonable go the 500 miles. And so while Vukovich is being interviewed in victory lane with the cars going by, that's the people that are trying to finish ninth and you know, 11th and whatever it was. Anyway, in 1919, I saw just recently somebody suggesting, or there was some source suggested that the race was not held in 1917 rather because of the flu epidemic, and that's not true. They had already, when there was going to be a 1917 500, and there was all kinds of rumors about it, you know, when the United States was going to enter the war, and I think it was finally like the beginning of March of 17 when the government, you know, when they had to pull the plug, because the government said, you know, we're shutting everything down because we're going to go racing. So when they came back in 1919, the flu epidemic had come and gone in the meantime. There was a casualty within racing. Johnny Aiken, who'd won all three of the races on the extra program held, I think was at September the 9th of 1916, the Harvest Day Classic, and then was the first vice president for Allison Engineering when it was very much in its infancy. He was a casualty, with a driver, first guy to lead the race in 1911, and then also was the pit manager for the winning cars in 12 and 13. Anyway, I went off on a little bit of a tangent there. But when they came back in 1919, I think the flu epidemic, I think, was over. I'm not aware that it had any bearing on the race. And as far as the 1919 race, a lot to fit in here. We don't have very much time. Howdy Wilcox was the winner, born in Crawfordsville, lived most of his life in Indianapolis, driving a Peugeot that was owned by Jim Allison and Carl Fisher, and it was kept in the what had just become Allison Engineering down on Main Street. That building down there was quite a story that we don't have time to get into now. And 1919 was the last year in which there were single lap qualifying. It was the next year when they went to the four lap qualifying system. There's so many stories. I'll wind up with this, that Howdy Wilcox mechanic was going to be Maurice Becker, who was actually born in France. So he was Maurice Becker, but it was Maurice Becker here. And on race morning, he said, "I can't run. My wife is kicking up a fuss, and I can't ride in the race." He had a young fellow named Leo Banks jumped in at the last moment. He was in the car on race day in the Victory Circle. And when he was interviewed by the newspapers afterwards, he said, "I've got to let my mother know what I was doing here, because she's going to hear it from friends. She didn't know I was going to be doing this today, and neither did I until I got to the track this morning." Anyway, there's tons of stories like that, and that's what we love about the place. We love the story. So thanks, everybody. Last night, we had left somebody holding that I know wanted to talk about Al Gordon, and I was hoping he'd call back. I'd like to, if that fellow's listening, call back tomorrow. I'd like to talk about Al Gordon. But anyway, thanks,
or
everybody.
You can just talk about Al Gordon tomorrow night if you'd like to.
I'll do that. That's fine.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Donald. We'll see you tomorrow night at 8 o'clock, or at least hear you. And trackside at 7. Thanks to Brad Huber in our studio and everyone that participated on the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.